Thank you. Hi, everyone. And I'll have the pleasure to do that with three speakers. So Adam Bornstein from the Red Cross, Brian Kerwin from Vest2, and Mike Rich from K2. And maybe, Mike, I'll start with you. And before talking about the future, maybe I would like you to talk about the current market. Maybe what's happening at the moment, what's the investor sentiment, and if you see any potential to bring new capital to the market over the short, medium, and long term.
Right. Thanks, Guillaume. And just in terms of investor sentiment, probably since the start of, is the mic not on? Just in terms of investor sentiment, probably since the tail end of 2017, we've seen more of a shift among investors towards the lower risk segment within ILS. We've seen what some would call a flight to quality that was occurring even before COVID, where cat bonds were much more desired.
He could hear you, but not at the back.
I think they gave you the one they wanted to give me.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want me to talk too much.
They'll switch you off after a while, so I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Tess, we're good?
Good.
All right. So just in terms of investor sentiment, we've seen a shift over the last 5 or so years following the heavy hurricane activity in 2017. Where investors were really looking to move up the risk tower with regards to ILS and focus more on the cat bond market. And I think that's probably for several reasons. One being the liquidity for cat bonds is substantially better than the private direct reinsurance or retro contracts. They like the flexibility to potentially trade in and out with that active secondary market. Liquidity is also a pretty key consideration. Within the cat bond market, there's not nearly as much side pocketing going on. So there's a much shorter tail and really defined end period. So at the maturity of those contracts, investors will be able to get that capital back to reallocate to future opportunities if the market is conducive to that. And we've really seen that in just in terms of growth of the cat bond market, both in total size and types of sponsors. So at the beginning of 2017, the cat bond market was about $20 billion. In notional, and currently we're right about $37-38 billion. So almost doubling in a little over 5 years is pretty fantastic growth. And we've seen a lot of growth coming from more retail type investors on the UCITS side. I think we're right at about $9 billion of AUM there, which has seen pretty tremendous growth over the last couple of years. So in terms of growth opportunities and investor sentiment, right now the cat bond market is within ILS probably one of the more attractive investment opportunities, especially over the short and medium term. We've seen where spreads have gone over the last 8 weeks with a pretty severe repricing downwards, which has made the entry point all that much more attractive. And then you combine that with the collateral return, and you're, for the first time in a while, seeing a total return potential of double digits, which to investors who may have been looking at the space on the outside is a number that they wanted to see. We're having these conversations with investors at a 5-7% yield to maturity. It's something like, yeah, we understand the benefits of the asset class, but we need more juice. So from a total return perspective on an absolute basis, it's definitely becoming a much more attractive investment opportunity. And then on the longer term, I think ILS and cat bonds in particular have proven it themselves to be a long-term diversified source of returns over the last 10 to 15 years. In fact, as you all know, the cat bond Swiss Re market was up every year since 2017. And so to see that resiliency in a time where there's significantly elevated event activity throughout the world is just another facet that is quite attractive for the cat bond market.
So yeah, that's pretty good. We see that there is potential to grow on the investor side, which means that we need to see more transactions coming in. I think one way to do that is to bridge the insurance gap. That's something which has been discussed this morning already. Adam, with the Red Cross, you're working on that. You brought to the market a transaction on a parametric basis covering volcanic eruption. Do you see some opportunity to do more of the same, or maybe to do new things? And what would be your constraints going forward, if any?
Thanks. The Red Cross, we did it with Reflexis and Mitiga on our the modeling side. One of the reasons we got into that was to demonstrate for humanitarian organizations that it's possible to play in this market. It's possible to securitize. And the entry point doesn't have to be a 144A, or it doesn't have to be millions of dollars to make that possible, right? So you need to lower that entry point, that hurdle, so that organizations that aren't pulling in, you know, multi-million dollars in income, but are actually delivering multi-million dollars in humanitarian assistance can be active. And so the constraint being premium, like where does premium come from? And that's been a constraint for a long time. And there are a couple organizations, governments that provide some of that financing. But we need to solve that problem. And so one of the bigger opportunities now is around climate. And for example, we're doing a project in the Philippines where we're actually blending a cat bond, a typhoon cat bond, with carbon credits. And so we set up a trust fund. We pre-fund that with some catalytic capital. That premium then, the capital within that trust fund goes to pay for the premium, but then it also goes to plant trees. And then we partner with an organization, like a carbon developer, who will basically put money up front for us to go ahead and actually plant additional trees, and they will buy carbon credits. And so from the income from those carbon credits get dumped back into the trust fund, and we go and continue to pay for our premium. And if there's ever kind of a trigger that happens, that money then goes back into the trust fund to continue the process. And so trying to find these kind of blended structures are really helpful, but you can't do it if the price tag to enter is so extreme. And, you know, part of it too comes down to like the power and the dynamics within the industry and who holds the power and how do they control who does what and how it plays. And so I think, you know, what will enable other organizations to do things like this is to figure out those platforms that allow that entry point to be dramatically lower. So yeah.
Yeah, I guess Mike, you can relate to that, because these transactions, I guess, would be pretty interesting to diversify the portfolio, but then given the current market conditions where spreads are really high, it's, I guess, difficult for you to decide how to get involved.
Yeah, there's a push-pull dynamic there. Obviously, as an investor, you have a fiduciary responsibility to the client, so you're going to want to be compensated appropriately for taking that level of risk for some of these newer and esoteric perils that may not have the long history of an event set or a strong modeling background, but also at the same time being sensitive to that it is the American Red Cross, so.
British, Danish.
It is the Red Cross. So pricing power for them may be limited based on what they're really willing to spend, or if they're able to really hit the marks where the current market environment may be at any given point in time.
Or even countries, as Michael talked about earlier today, right? Like that price point, like I can do a 10, I can do a $20 million project, but I can't do a 200 or 100 million. It's just way outside the scope. So
yep.
You gotta make the market, you know, you gotta go to the market, meet the market.
Another way to grow the market, and I think you're addressing that, Brian, is maybe to go to another segment of the market, because the cat bond is a cat heavy, and with this too, you're trying to give access to a non-cat business to ILS investors. Maybe you can comment a bit more on that and what kind of risk you're bringing them.
Well, I think Lloyd's actually sort of made my presentation for me when you look what they're trying to do. So they're trying to move outside the cat world and to basically sell their ability in the non-cat. I think the non-correlation bet has probably already been made. So people are sort of, the world we're in, and say, okay, we're not in cat. People have bought into the non-correlation piece. For me, when I was thinking for Vestu, before I was in Allianz, and we used to think through how do you compete in a digital environment? So when someone owns distribution, when you're sort of losing your brand identity, you're trying to figure out, okay, how do you compete in a digital environment? Well, obviously, we've got an environment where there's a lot more data on all these lines of business. There's a lot more capability to analyze that data. And I suppose Lloyd's is more where you have expert underwriters. What we're trying to move towards is a more digital-based system where we have expert automation. So we're essentially automating the process using, I wouldn't say AI, but using sort of Bayesian theory, other structured machine learning. So we're using that to analyze data and then bring investors in that way into the environment. So the target area is not CAT, it's insurance risk, liabilities. I think what was helpful, Philippe, thankfully I didn't have to hand in my CV because he was asked, is this a sustainable market? And thankfully he said yes, so that gave me help. But if you think about the difference is what we're trying to build is a very scalable model. So it's based on machine learning, it's based on digital. So therefore, you can handle an awful lot of risk, awful lot of data at the same time, and you can build up a very significant portfolio with a much smaller cost base. So if you think about the industry, where you have a very strong distribution source, which is the brokers, which essentially own the distribution and sort of commoditize who they're selling into. So you can see you can either try and fight against that by having lots of stadiums named in your name and hope that people actually find your brand so exciting they'll go around the broking. It doesn't really happen. Or you can sort of admit, which like Key and others are admitting, that they are a digital environment, that they are commoditized, and how do you actually compete? Well, you compete on scale and you compete on automation. So we're very much building that strategy. The bit for us, obviously, I think you mentioned track record, people buying into the models, people buying into what we're doing, the returns in the market. So we are, sorry, I won't go on about us too much, but hopefully that reflects to the market. So we're sourcing insurance risk, modeling it, and then obviously with the capital markets, structuring it and selling it. So we're sort of covering all sides of that. And I think the excitement for our area, it's not just CAT, it's a much broader, much bigger market, much wider insurance market. I think Lloyd's is showing a pace, sort of proof of concept on the non-digital. We're aiming to be sort of that digital marketplace.
Okay.
Hopefully that answers the question.
Yep.
Okay.
And we're seeing that we have like new and innovative way to bring new transactions to the market, but also, Mike, I'd like to have your opinion on what about we just do more of the same? As you said, the cat bond market is really interesting at the moment. Yields are probably above 10% now on the cat bond portfolio. So what about also doing more of US nat cat with some diversifiers around the world?
Yeah, I'd say at least in terms of what we'd like to see in growth of the cat bond market is maybe moving away from the U.S. It's pretty heavily dominated U.S. southeast wind. So to see some potential newer or more diversified region perils to help potentially close some of the insurance gap with some of what the Red Cross or the World Bank is trying to accomplish in some of these smaller markets that have historically been underinsured. To work to try to transfer some of that risk to the capital markets and really diversify the peril region exposure, as well as bringing new sponsors into the market. We've seen over the last several years, the corporates have begun to access the market with Google and Prologis. We've seen a mortgage-backed security hedge fund access the cap bond market, as well as some traditional insurance companies over the last few years. That have issued their first cap bond and by all indications were happy with the execution there and could potentially return to the market. So I think the two key factors for growth and doing more of the same thing would be to try to work to diversify some of the risk from a region peril perspective, as well as really continue to grow that sponsor base to really further diversify those types of deals and those types of sponsors that are bringing deals to the cap bond market who may not have in the past.
Do you see the spreads when you go outside the states? That used to be the problem in the old days,
yeah.
Was trying to get the spreads in the more regional, ex-US.
And I think the recent event activity outside of the US will probably help the spread environment there and make it potentially more attractive or palatable for potential investors. You had the multiple years of in Japan in a row with pretty severe typhoon activity. And I think for years prior to that, Japan was always looked at as are really trying to squeeze every margin out of investors as possible. And I think they're working to really pay that back now. It's likely going to be a multi-year process that we're in the middle of to try to really bring those rates up to the point where investors will feel that they're being fairly compensated for taking that risk. And even last year with the European flooding, that was relatively unimpactful for the cat bond market. But given the flooding of activity and the potential for investors to really, they want that diversification. They just haven't been able to wrap their heads around the pricing that they'd be receiving. So post-event, in a perfect world, the pricing will get to a point where some of these diversifying perils would be more attractive to the traditional cat bond investor and manager.
And maybe, Adam, then shifting the focus from the investors to the sponsor and more particularly to the Red Cross, we've heard that there is this fiduciary duty on the investor side. And then on the Red Cross side, what would be the motivation to come to the market? And how do you make sure this aligns well with the Red Cross values?
Mm-hmm. The motivation, to transfer risk. The Red Cross had never touched insurance of any kind, even like health insurance. We basically pay out of pocket for employees. So when we did the cat bond with Cedric and Howden and others, that was the first step into the insurance space. So that was a huge learning. And but for that to happen, we helped set up that do not re, which is the insurance structure, the ICC in Guernsey, and that is actually an ESG compliant. I think it was the first insurance platform in Guernsey that was ESG compliant. That means that everything we're issuing is like a green product, right? It's classified and it trades, right? It trades in the TISE now, the bond, part of the sustainability bond index. So the point being is, from the Red Cross perspective, we bringing this type of product to the market to create a platform allows us then to think differently about structured products and how can we use leverage, and so and that goes from like debt swaps and things of that nature. But really the idea is pulling more money into the humanitarian space. Like it's about $18-19 billion market every year. But the needs are $60 to $70 billion dollars a year, right? So you can't do that unless you have access to some kind of leverage, right? Banks get to use fractional banking, right? Development banks get to use their huge balance sheets. World Bank gets to use the balance sheets. We don't get to use our balance sheet. So we have to do this type of stuff. And so in the United States, foundations are by law, they have to commit 5% of their assets under management every year to charitable causes. That's a revenue stream that's there every year. So $1.3 trillion US is the size of the foundation market. So 5% of that is around $750 to $700 billion. That's a great source of capital for these type of products, but you need to create a product for them to pull it in. So I like to say the Red Cross definitely focus on the humanitarian side. We're super transparent. You know, you throw out an ESG type product, you tap into the $1 trillion market space there. But people understand that we're transparent, so we can probably give you a product that you know that's up there with the highest quality ESG product. Plenum is one of our investors, and obviously Schroders in the cat bond. So you know, Plenum is an ESG, from what I understand, is an ESG fund. If I got it wrong, I apologize. But that's what we're trying to do, is to attract different types of investors with different product.
And I think together with Replexus, you're also pretty innovative because the transaction you brought to the market was blockchain-based,
yep.
Which I think makes me come to the point of the technological innovation maybe in the cat bond market or in the LS market. And Brian, this is something you're definitely doing with the Vestu marketplace where you're trying to exchange risk using AI. Can you elaborate on this, and where do you see the growth potential there?
Yeah,
in the next few years?
You probably take our data scientist would give you a lot better view of our Bayesian structured analytics. Fundamentally, as I come back to the business model and the idea behind it, is how do you create a significant business leverage? So when you want to grow, rather than adding underwriters, rather than adding structures, how do you grow insurance? If you look at, from, I think, the hedge fund industry, who used to be a few guys running 100 million of assets. Now the same sort of teams are running multiple billion of assets. So you basically create leverage in the system using analytics. The analytics themselves, probably beyond my capability, but it's really machine learning. So it's using data on a simple basis, just using the triangulation data. So the advantage there is, rather than having an actuary per triangulation, we can basically absorb vast amounts of deals in one go. So you can actually analyze on multiple platforms in multiple ways and use sort of machine learning to figure out, right, how accurate are your predictions. The fundamental on that, obviously, is then proving to the market and the capital markets that that makes sense to the investors. So there's a lot of backtesting of the models, a lot of structures where you have to sit in front of people and get comfortable with our analytics. So the first end is we've created sort of the business model. We use the brokers to absorb the risk in. We use the analytics to gear that up. And then we have a team who are mostly here somewhere, probably hiding because I'm speaking, on the capital market side that then structure that and sell that on. The business model then, you know, it's going to be very interesting for us as we build the business is creating that comfort with the investor base that our models are structured in a way that people are comfortable with the outcome and the structure. There may be some alignment with experts within that environment so that people get comfortable with other track record that we're supporting, either MGAs or other structures. But essentially, the fundamental piece, it's not blockchain-based, but it's the ability to absorb huge amount of data and analyze it. Not for our business, but when I was in my previous company, you know, the vast change that's going to happen in the market is still Internet of Things. I don't know, people have stopped talking about it for 2 years, but when you look at the major corporations, which I think Clive brought up, you look at the data they have on their risk and how real-time it is, that real-time data is going to change how people think about captive insurance because they're going to have much, much clearer insight into their risk. And I think you'll see much larger portfolios coming to market that will basically benefit from this sort of AI approach as opposed to sort of individual traded deals. So I think the specialist market will stay the same, but gradually this sort of portfolio-based approach, a data-driven approach, is going to become more sustained in the market. And that's the piece that us as a business are trying to take advantage of.
Do you think this technology in the future could be used for cat bonds?
The only cool stuff I used to on cat bonds was the parametric, where all people putting the measuring items all around the. So when we used to sell it in the cat bond side, the parametric was what everyone wanted until they couldn't figure out the basis risk. So for me, that was a technological change that I'm sure you guys know more than me. But it's all about the data absorption, where you're getting the data from. And I think that's. If we're talking here in 3 or 4 years, there'll be a lot of new products based on data flow and automated pricing. Obviously, I quite enjoyed the cyber discussion today. I wasn't sure I'd invest in cyber, but I did want to comment from my previous world again, the demand for cyber is insane. And every company on the earth needs a structure. So there will be a solution to cyber. I don't say we have it now, but I've probably never seen in the industry such a massive demand from the customer base, the industry sort of going, yeah, we tried that, we didn't quite get it right. And sort of that will then move into a captive environment or another structured environment because all these companies are not going to just be unhedged in that environment. There's just no way. So I think if I look at anything that's going to change the market, someone's going to figure out a cyber structure that works in the environment that works for the large corporates. Because I just don't see that being an unsolved structure. But the guys who are on the panel are way, way more expert than I would ever be in the topic. But I just know the level of demand relative to the expertise in the industry is probably going to make sure that will be the next big thing.
I think so. Maybe another point, and I'm a bit surprised I'm the first one, I think, to bring the topic today, is climate change. And I think this will have, in some ways, an impact on the growth of our market. And Adam, I think on your side, it's pretty clear that vulnerable populations tend to suffer the most from climate change. So how do you see that? And maybe, Mike, afterwards, you can comment more generally on this market.
Yeah, so climate is accounting for like 60-70% of the problems that we face as an organization and as a community. And the issue with climate or environment is that you get used to a certain status or certain status quo. So, for example, in Somalia and the Horn of Africa, for the last 5 years, there's been a drought. For the last four, no one really talked about it. They just accepted that it was happening. But humanitarian organizations get money when there's a massive crisis. And so we're always putting out fires. We're never sort of looking into the future. So for 4 years, money doesn't go into the communities. There's no rural development. There's no resilience buildings. There's no shock absorbers. As we all know from COVID, you need very resilient and robust shock absorbers. That doesn't exist. So then a crisis comes. Money flows into the communities. But it's too late because the damage has been done for the last 4 years. So this is what happens. And what we need to do is figure out a way to finance the steady state, how to keep operations, how to keep people on the ground so they build that resilience, and to somehow use that big trigger effect that happens at the end to pay for that. And that's one of the projects we're doing with famine relief right now in Somalia, where we essentially get investors to put money up front to run these programs. And then we have a cat at the back, a parametric, that's based on like IPC 3 or 4, which are just like drought indicators. And if that happens, the cap bond releases the money, and it goes back into the system to pay back the investors. And then you have appeals that kind of like take care of that, right? So that's a way to use cap bonds as to sort of finance our operations. Whereas I know you don't try and make money off a cap bond. We're looking at ways to mobilize the resources. And so climate has a huge impact in what we're doing. It goes from the Mangrove Trust Fund that I mentioned before, where we're selling carbon credits against the activities that the communities do in the restoration, the reforestation. And we're also using cats on the back end to cover initial investments. So it's everywhere. It's everywhere.
Yeah, and just in terms from a broader ILS perspective on climate change, it's having quite a big impact just on the number of events. We've seen higher frequency of events, and those events that have happened would be at a higher severity. So that combination has been a struggle for certain types of bonds that have structural considerations. These multi-peril aggregate indemnity bonds have definitely fallen out of favor compared to 4, 5, 6 years ago. And we've seen some sponsors really work to try to rectify some of the potential pitfalls, whether it's raising the franchise deductible for a qualifying event or adding a per event deductible or even a max contribution from one single event to really try to mitigate the impact from this higher frequency, higher severity events. And one thing in terms of just wind season and hurricanes that we've seen a noticeable impact from climate change is really just the rapid intensification of storms and how that's impacting the overall response preparedness for the regions who have historically had to deal with hurricanes. We saw last year in Louisiana, Hurricane Ida intensified quite quickly from a Cat 1-2 to a 4-5, leading to issues with evacuations in the Gulf, in the New Orleans area, because those response and evacuation plans needed a minimum of 48 to 72 hours to really get everything moving, to close the proper roads, to have everything mobilized to evacuate these residents safely. And just because of how quickly that storm strengthened last year, you weren't able to really implement those plans. So there are a lot of different moving pieces and factors that as an ILS market and an investor, as it relates to climate change, that we're going to need to continue to work and evolve and become more comfortable with really taking that type of risk.
Can I add one point to that? So the issue with climate, too, is the cascade effects. So we've looked at a lot of multi-peril cap bonds to try and put different solutions together. And we've applied for lots of grants and spoken with lots of individuals. The problem is the cascade. So you can insure, say, a drought or a severe storm or cold front. But what happens if you get, like, a mudslide? Like, how does that get insured? You can't. You have to do the prime because there's no data. No investor's going to take risk on a mudslide. So that's our huge problem that we face. It's like, sure, okay, let's do a severe cold. But then what about frostbite? Or what about lack of electricity? That if you can help us solve those problems without making it more expensive, I appreciate it.
I don't know if you want to add anything, or I think we have some more time to take questions.
Sure. Just to let you know, we can help you with the mudslides from Honolulu. We predicted the severe 5% rare Kona low in December last year. We were the first to do it. And the Biden administration gave us a thank you. So just to let you know, you've got a climate company here that can help you out with that.
Okay.
Aloha.
Aloha. Shaka.
Well, despite last night, I think I was told I had to buy a house in the metaverse. So I don't know if that's the future of the industry, but it's probably hurricane prone anyway. The way things are going, look, I think with some of the other comments on the changes, I think what we are definitely going to see, and the banks are seeing it, is more direct capital involved, more innovative capital, and definitely as you see the insurance industry, you'll hear I think a lot of people talking about the supply chain. It's so complex and so costly all the way through. We still have an industry that is astonishingly expensive to do what is basically a paper trade or a digital trade, on not on the claim side, but on the premium side. So from an execution point of view, we've talked about I've talked about the future for the last, it's now the past for me, obviously, but the cost base still hasn't gone away, and it's an astonishing cost when you look at the business and where we're going to a digital environment. So we constantly talk about change, we constantly talk about digitalization, we constantly talk about disintermediation, but we're not seeing that. We're just seeing a very costly industry in terms of what the value is to the client. So if people ask me what the future holds, I think no matter how good we get at what we're doing, if we don't solve some of the supply chain structures or the structural issues in the business, I think it's going to be very hard to bring that value add to the clients. So we can be as smart as we want, but if we're taking 40 points out, 45 points out of the claims number and the traditional side, so I think that's, you know, controversial, but I think that's going to be the challenge for the industry in the next phase of the environment. Although we're hearing some phenomenal underwriting results, there's still some pretty significant cost base in the structure and inefficient capital, which I think has to be solved.
There's probably also a space around Islamic financing. That's a huge market, and they have Takaful and a couple products. But, you know, 40% of Africa is Islamic based, and so how to look at insurance from that perspective, because insurance is basically haram. You know, you can't touch it. And so, you know, thinking about the dark arts of insurance and applying it in these contexts without actually kind of calling it something is a really interesting space. And we're doing something in Somalia where we've actually worked with Allianz, and we're, you know, creating like an insurance product that sits outside the country but applies it internally. And so, you know, I think you'd have to look at it completely holistically, the whole market, and not just say like where we're comfortable. And I think that's a real challenge, opportunity though.